We'll hear arguments next in Kulko against the Superior Court of California. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case arises in an action for child support in the state of California as a consequence of the departure of two children from the custody of their father and the home that they had enjoyed all of their lives in the state of New York. The matter comes before you as a final judgment of the Supreme Court of California under California rules, which permit us to bifurcate issues of jurisdiction and challenge those up through the courts, which is done by a writ of mandate and was done in this case. We submit that this court has jurisdiction by virtue of the nature of the California statute, which is involved in this particular case. In particular, this particular statute states, a court of this state may exercise jurisdiction on any basis not inconsistent with the Constitution of this state and or of the United States. In the Legislative Judicial Council comments, the legislature adopted the statement that the sufficiency of such contacts is a matter of constitutional law on which the Supreme Court of the United States has the final voice. So as a consequence, in this particular action before you, there's almost a coexistence between the construction of the statute and its application. I might submit to the court that I think there's a question with respect to the omnibus type of statute in terms of it being an improper delegation of the legislative duty to the courts, or possibly even vagueness, but that has not been the approach raised by the appellant in this case. The approach in this particular case is how this statute is applied as being unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. We also submit that the issue of mootness raised by the appellee is not appropriate in this case because, in fact, in each case, at each level, this was raised solely on special appearance to challenge the jurisdiction of the court. The trial court so found at each level that this was an issue of special appearance. Even after the proceedings, the trial court found that we had appeared only by special appearance. And I might add that in the Titus case, cited by us, the specific act of advising the court after it had already denied a motion to quash that the matter was going up on appeal and did not have jurisdiction was found by the appellate court to not constitute an appearance at that time. Lastly, Your Honors, we submit that the issue of mootness is inappropriate in a situation or in a society in which there has generally been an attitude of expanding jurisdiction, and
Mr.
in which
certain... could I interrupt you here at this point?
Certainly, Justice Bachman.
Anywhere or at any time was ever any attack made on the decree, the Haitian decree of divorce in this case?
No, sir. And that was the decree in which the appellee moved to be established in California in the initial action filed in California.
Do you think it's invulnerable to attack at this late date?
I do, sir.
You do?
Yes, sir.
It recites on its face that both parties are domiciled and resident other than in Haiti.
I think, Justice Blackmun, that there is enough authority both in New York and in California that these parties would be estopped to take a position inconsistent with their joint acts in going to Haiti. And therefore, I certainly would not have advised that by my client, and I would imagine the other side would take the same position.
Have both parties remarried?
Yes, sir.
The doctor, too?
Yes, sir. Lastly, as I was saying, it would seem to me that many of the commentators seem to suggest that to test issues of jurisdiction, we should not be engaged in a type of a wager at law in which we act at our peril in trying to test out jurisdiction. Certainly the attempt here, in no case was there ever an attempt by the appellant to deal with the merits.
Well, anyway, I thought your argument basically is that California law allows special appearances without waiver.
Yes, sir.
And that's what was the procedure you followed.
Precisely.
Well, isn't that the complete answer?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Now, in this particular case, the appellant, Ezra Kulko, differs materially from the type of parties which have generally been before this court in state court jurisdiction cases relating to non-residents. We have here an average citizen, family man, engaged in common family interactions. He is not a corporation. He is not involved in doing business or acts for economic benefits, such as generally all of the cases that have been involved in this matter in the past have been involved. This is the type of individual that strikes all across the breadth of this country's activities. From the penthouse to the ghetto, there are people engaging in the split of their family and entering into marital settlement agreements of the type engaged in this particular case. And I submit that the activities of this particular party, or of both of these parties, are acts that are going on by thousands of citizens across the country monthly, if not weekly. Second, Dr. Kulko, in this case, is both a resident and a domiciliary of the state of New York. He was born, educated, married, established his home there, and for all intents and purposes, with a few exceptions, has never left the state. He is not the typical father who has departed from the domicile state in order to escape his obligations. He has remained in the state of the marital domicile. In this particular case, on the contrary, it is the appellee, the wife, who has departed from the domicile state, who has obtained, in essence, to use what some of the commentators talk about as the migratory or suitcase divorce, with the consent of the husband. And in addition, it should be borne in mind that each of the two children, at two-year intervals, also departed from the state of New York and from the residence of the father by their own choice. Now, in addition, we have here recognition that at the time of the filing of Mrs. Horn's complaint, the father was the legal custodian of both of these two children by virtue of a marital settlement agreement, which, if Your Honors please, was negotiated, prepared, executed, and carried out in the state of New York by Mrs. Horn's attorney, Dr. Horn not being represented by choice, and which Mrs. Horn flew from California to New York in order to execute and complete the negotiations at that particular time.
You're getting me a little bit confused. Where was the decree entered?
The decree was entered in Haiti, Your Honor, after a
Not in New York.
If I said the decree, then I stand corrected.
No.
That's correct, Chief Justice.
Just to be clear, you seem to be now arguing New York domicile.
Well, I think the New York...
When both parties consented to the divorce in another place.
I think the facts Mr. Chief Justice, of New York domicile is important in this case, but not for the traditional reasons that there was a decree entered in New York, but simply because the facts and circumstances relating to the parties and their agreement as negotiated in New York gives a great deal of importance to the ties that New York would give to its contracts and certainly to its negotiated marital settlement agreements. It's significant, I submit, that it was Mrs. Kulko who departed from New York to obtain the decree and subsequently was married in the state of California. Under circumstances which, based upon her residence in California, she could have, at the time, obtained the typical type of no-fault divorce or dissolution allowed by California, but she chose instead to come east and go through the arrangements at that particular time. So she had the option at that time of getting jurisdiction in the state of California.
But she preferred to have this marriage settlement, didn't she?
I'm sorry, Justice Marshall.
She preferred to have the marriage settlement, cash.
That's correct. She preferred to have the arrangements that could be made at that time in New York.
Now, at that time, at what time are we talking about, Mr. Stoddard?
We're talking about at the time of the marital settlement agreement and the Haitian decree, which took place only a matter of days separating each other.
They were living in New York as domiciliaries of New York, as husband and wife.
That's correct, at all times.
Up to the time of the Haitian decree, at least.
To the time of their separation.
Until they went to Haiti, or somebody went to Haiti and got a divorce, and I suppose the jurisdictional support for that divorce was somebody's domicile in Haiti. But in any event, they had been living in New York. And after the divorce in Haiti, the husband, your client, returned to New York, where he's lived ever since, except for some military duty.
It ran this way. The parties and the family always lived in New York.
Right.
The wife departed from the family, leaving the father and the children in the state of New York.
Before or after the divorce?
Before.
Before the divorce. Mm-hmm.
They then go, and she went to California.
Uh-huh.
They then entered into a marital settlement agreement, all of which took place in New York. All aspects of it.
She personally, or did her
she
lawyer?
Her lawyer negotiated, and then she personally came from California to New York to execute the agreement, and then left from New York, she did, to go to Haiti with consent of the
And she obtained the decree
doctor,
in
and
Haiti.
And she obtained
That's
the decree of Haiti,
comment.
And then she returned to California, and the father returned to the family home with where the children were, which he had never departed.
He returned from where?
I'm sorry, the father never
continued to
live
reside
there.
In New York.
That's correct.
At that time also with the children.
That's correct.
Mr. Tucker, isn't the issue we have to decide whether Dr. Kulko did anything in California that subjected him to in personam jurisdiction in that state, isn't that it?
Yes, sir.
When are you going to get to that?
I will in a moment, sir.
Your time's running.
I think that the court should recognize that one of the major issues involved here is whether the contacts required to establish personal jurisdiction under international shoe should be of a more substantial type or nature in domestic or family law proceedings than those existing in other cases. And I submit to your honors that this is made particularly clear by the restatement, Section 37. In the restatement, your honors, Section 37, which deals with the question of doing an act having an effect elsewhere, they talk about three things: intent, foreseeability, and no intent. When one reads all of the statements made by the commissioners, in intent, we're talking about the shooting of a missile or a bullet. In foreseeability, we're talking about allowing your car to be driven by somebody else across state lines or putting explosives that might have an effect. None of these type of circumstances were clearly contemplated by the commissioners when they adopted this particular type of criteria. Significantly, in the caveat to this restatement, they talk about defamation possibly being an exception that should be handled differently with more substantial types of matters, raising, in essence, questions of free speech. And I submit to your honors that in this particular case, the question of invasion of privacy, the decision of the rights of a family to decide where their children should live, is significantly appropriate.
Well, you're here attacking the judgment of California, and I think it would be very helpful to us. It certainly would be to me if you'd tell me what it is that's wrong about California's assertion of jurisdiction based upon their contact with the children and the wife.
Well, if Your Honor, please, California had two lower court cases, both of which rejected the concept that these type of acts were essentially the type of acts that were contemplated by this type of a criteria. It's our contention that Dr. Kulko really passively went along with the daughter who decided that she wanted to come to California. And we submit, if Your Honors look, that in the pleadings here, paragraph 10 of the original complaint filed in here makes a specific allegation that the father threatens to remove the children from the state of California and asks for a restraining order. At that particular time, when the original pleading was filed, the trial court issued a restraining order against the removal of both of those children. So that we submit that suggestions made by the California Supreme Court that this was a voluntary act or a consent by the father to send his children into the state of California is untrue. What we're involved with is a situation where...
But didn't the father pay for the airfare?
Yes, sir.
Well, isn't that consent?
Not in the traditional situation, Your Honors. Let me put it this way. We have here a considerate, concerned father who is attempting to work out in the family interaction what would be the best solution for the children. On the other side, if we would place a father who was obstinate, who would not pay anything, who would not cooperate, I think this court would therefore say that the non-cooperative litigant type father would have done no acts and therefore not be subject to jurisdiction. But the father who is facing reality and who says to when the daughter says, I want to live with my mother, okay, if that's your choice, I think you're wrong, but I'll buy you a ticket and wish you well. The court in California was saying that's a type of act conferring jurisdiction.
The mother in this case sought in persona money judgment against your client, did she not?
Right. No, there's no proceedings relative to any action filed by the mother at any time claiming in the state of New York or anywhere else claiming that father was indebted to her for some act or acts.
What did the mother seek in her action in the Superior Court of California?
The mother sought only to establish the Haitian decree and to establish child support prospectively. This was not an action to establish...
Did she ask for an increase?
That's correct.
It's a little different from what you just said.
Well, that's an in persona money judgment.
That's correct. She's asking for an in persona money judgment in the future.
And also custody of the children.
And also custody, which we did not contest. No. So the issue comes before the court solely on her right to seek, through California courts, a larger sum of money.
Well, the real question is, did the California court have personal jurisdiction over your client?
That's
in
correct.
In this case. That's the issue.
That's the very bottom issue.
But the answer to that question may turn on whether simply an adjustment of custody was sought or on whether an in persona money judgment was sought, may it not? I mean, it may differ.
It does differ. Traditionally, the courts have viewed questions of custody as relating solely to issues of status.
Right.
And they have viewed questions of money judgment as being a type of in personam jurisdiction of a type which in Vanderbilt this court ruled would not apply as far as alimony is concerned.
Well, page 7 of the appendix, which contains the complaint, paragraph 4 of the complaint, clearly asks for money, the court to award money to the plaintiff against the defendant, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
And the question is, did the court have jurisdiction? That's the question we have.
And
I mean, as a matter of constitutional law, could the court assert jurisdiction over your client?
And the position of the appellant is no, because the appellant has absolutely no contact with the state of California in any respect, has never entered the California in any position, in any circumstance, was not doing business, did not do an intentional act of the type which this court has found applies in the economic sphere in other types of cases. We're involved in this particular case with the interaction between families, in which we submit would have a very counter effect when families are left with a decision that by being cooperative, they would thereby be conferring jurisdiction. We just don't feel that that measures up to the standards which this court has submitted in the past. I might add that another aspect of this relates to the question of the foreseeability type circumstances in which Justice Stevens mentioned in the Schaefer case, in which he equates fair notice to include fair warning. And I submit that as a general rule, parents deciding that allowing their children who have asked to go with another parent do not thereby have knowledge or are aware of the fact that they are conferring jurisdiction in a court 3,000 miles away to decide how much money they may have to pay in the future. I also submit to the court the question that ordinarily one thinks in terms of the state's right to protect the children that are within its domicile. In this particular case, there's no determination that the amount of money awarded in New York might not already have been sufficient, and that it really would be a question of just how well the children should live. Under those particular circumstances, it's not a decision that these children were somehow going to be thrown into poverty. We have the Uniform Reciprocal Support Act and the right of the mother to, as she did at the time of the marital settlement agreement, to come back to New York and in the first instance have New York settle her particular money problems. In this particular case, she judiciously chose to avoid New York, presumably because she felt that she would not be treated well in New York because essentially she had abandoned New York.
Except, Mr. Stutter, I suggest that what she did or didn't do is not relevant to the question we have to decide. We have to decide whether what he did, as the California Supreme Court held, sufficed to subject him in personam jurisdiction in California. And do you quarrel with the test that the California Supreme Court laid down? Did he purposely avail himself of the benefits and protections of California laws, or anticipate that he would derive any economic benefit or result of his act outside of California? Do you quarrel with that test?
Yes, sir.
I
don't quarrel with the test. I quarrel with the fact that he purposely
applied.
That's correct.
Right, and as I understand it, the way they applied it was said that probably no parental act more fully invokes the benefits and protections of California law than that by which a parent permits his minor child to live in California. We start with a premise that a non-resident parent who allows his minor child or children to reside in California has by that act purposely availed himself of the benefits and protections of the laws of California. Do you quarrel with that?
Not a fact. It seems to me that a court does have a concern relative to the choice of law question of protecting children that
well,
are
as I understand it, all yeah. that the court, what the court did was then go on to say what he did in letting his daughter come and buying her the airline ticket and those other facts, they established that he had committed an act in New York which had the effect of allowing his minor child and children to reside in California, and thus that he had purposely availed himself of the benefits and protections of the laws of California, and therefore, under the test that you say you don't quarrel with, that establish the basis for in personam jurisdiction.
Well, Justice Brennan, the question of the purposeful nature, I guess, is the factual question which, under this particular statute, is submitted to this particular court. And
you want us to decide the factual question?
No, sir. It seems to me that it's inappropriate to do so, and as a consequence, it seems that to place the father in a position where he must act at his peril in making the type of act which one would presume that any concerned father would make when confronted with a decision by a young child that says, I want to go with my mother. Now, having this being the state of the marital domicile, under all circumstances, this particular father had two choices. Either was to litigate, deny the request of the child, and enter into litigation in New York, or force litigation in New York, or cooperate in terms of allowing the child to go live with the mother. And I submit that that's not the type of purposeful activity for obtaining the privileges and benefits in the state of California, which this court has generally treated in the past.
And of course, your Supreme Court distinguished between the daughter and the son, saying that the father had done nothing in New York, which had the effect of committing the son to California in the same way that he had done with the daughter.
That's correct,
and
Justice.
And therefore, they refused to accept jurisdiction. Say there was no jurisdiction as to the increased support for the son, but only as to the daughter.
No,
correct?
Justice Brennan, they made the decision to the effect that while they recognized there was no contact, since they already had contact with the daughter, and since they felt the jurisdiction of the father was established by virtue of his single act of buying
daughter.
That ticket, they therefore said, we therefore will also apply it to the son
yes,
as well.
They finally wind up, we deem it fair and reasonable to subject him to personal jurisdiction for the support of both children, whereas committed acts with respect to one child, which confers personal jurisdiction and has consented to the permanent residence of the
because,
other.
Because, as they say...
No, you're right. So the judgment finally entered was increased support for both.
And they basically say that he consented to the son because he didn't commence an immediate action, even though at the time he was under a restraining order from the state of California against removing those children.
Mr. Stoddard, the airplane ticket, was it a round trip?
No, sir. It was a one-way ticket. That's correct.
Well, how did he expect the child to get back?
He had hoped that the child would recognize that life with the mother would not be as idyllic as she thought it would be, and that by giving her an opportunity for her day in California, so to speak, she would see that life in California was not as good as life in New York.
And the answer to my question is, how would the child get back? Walk?
I think the child would simply have called the father and said, in much the same way, I'd like to come back to New York, and a ticket instantly would have been available.
Mr. Stoddard, earlier you mentioned there might be a difference between jurisdiction to award a money judgment and jurisdiction to determine custody. Paragraph 3 of the complaint asks just for a modification of the decree to award permanent custody to the wife. Paragraph 4 is the one that asks for money. Do you concede that there is jurisdiction to grant the relief provided in paragraph 3?
Yes. We have conceded that for purposes of the proceedings that we've brought. We, at the trial court level, raised questions that the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, certainly as to Darwin, would not apply. On the other hand, it was the advice of counsel, myself in this case, that the decision of a child of this age would certainly be very persuasive on a court, and therefore that the issue of jurisdiction should not be challenged on that issue. So the question of custody was not raised, and I think that there is no issue here relative to the custody question.
That didn't involve a matter of personal jurisdiction.
That's correct. I think custody is a type of status which can be handled totally different.
But the relief prayed for in that paragraph would result in a modification of the decree of the settlement agreement between the parties, wouldn't it?
That's correct. And relief as in terms of custody might well be granted without getting into money judgments at all.
Of course, it almost would follow inevitably under this settlement, as I understand it, that there would be some increase in the support money because the support under the agreement was calculated on the basis of temporary time with the wife. Wasn't that correct?
I think there's no question about the fact that both California and New York, as a choice of law issue, would have recognized that these children were entitled to support. The issue is, can California make these determinations as to what the father should pay, as distinguished from her going back to New York and the marital domicile, which has generally been very highly respected in family law proceedings, in which great importance has always been stressed in order to determine what the amount of child support should be.
Well, can a California court constitutionally order your client to pay money? That's the point.
And I think the
based
answer,
upon his relationships with the state,
and
as they are. There's no conflict of the facts.
And Justice Stewart, I think that's correct. The answer that we contend is no, on the basis of a single act, which is of a type of act done in this particular case and not of the type of acts done in the typical economic type of cases. Thank you.
Mrs. Thorne.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to begin by making three corrections, which I believe are relevant to the facts. Dr. Kuko was served in person and not by mail, as suggested in some of the briefs.
What difference does it make? No one's challenging the decree now, are they?
That's correct. Secondly, a very relevant fact
He was served in this litigation?
Yes, he was served personally.
In New York?
In New York,
oh,
yes.
No.
Secondly, the daughter, Ilsa, was 11 and a half years old at the time that she asked to live with her mother, and her father participated with her in that change of custody. Therefore, to suggest that it was a unilateral act does not seem appropriate. Further, Dr. Kolko was represented by an attorney at the time of the New York settlement agreement. I'd like to address myself first to the question of jurisdiction of this court with regard to this matter. Throughout the entire proceedings through the California Supreme Court, there was no attack made on the California statute, either on its face or as applied. We therefore submit that appeal is not applicable here.
But we could still treat it as certiorari, couldn't we?
That's correct, Your Honor. The defendant moved to quash the summons on the ground that the court lacked personal jurisdiction because he was a non-resident without sufficient contact with California to satisfy due process requirements. Furthermore, the circumstances of this case are most unusual, as are outlined in the brief for the appellee. They are unlikely to occur again and do not raise issues of national importance. I'd like to address myself, secondly, to the issue of mootness.
So you don't suggest there isn't a federal question, then? It's just one that,
on which it isn't a proper appeal and we should deny certiorari?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting...
Or are you also saying it's not a substantial federal question?
I'm suggesting that it's not a substantial federal question, Your Honor, because of the unique happenstance of facts in the situation.
Well, I would think Justice White's question and the Chief Justice's question pose two quite different inquiries. One is whether it's the kind of case that would recur frequently that this court would want to exercise discretionary jurisdiction over. And the other is whether there is any federal substantial federal claim here at all, even though the case is a real sport. Is your answer to both of those questions no, or both yes, or?
I think my answer to one would be no. Would you repeat the second one, Justice Rehnquist?
Well, I can conceive of a case where there might be a very substantial constitutional claim in the sense that a party litigant has had a constitutional right violated, and yet nonetheless one would say it's a set of facts that is never going to recur, and this court only takes 150 cases a year, and we simply wouldn't grant certiorari in a case like that. But if it were an appeal as of right, we would probably not feel free to say there was no substantial federal question.
I would answer yes to the second question.
You say that there really isn't any really doubtful federal question in the case, even though it were to recur time and again, it should be resolved in favor of state jurisdiction.
I'm saying, Your Honor, that this is a unique set of facts that doesn't justify the court in assuming jurisdiction.
Well, now let me ask you about that. Suppose the settlement
agreement here had given the custody to the parents, and at the time the lady was residing in California, which she was.
Yes, she was.
And so there was an agreement, a consensual agreement, that would be embodied in a decree that the wife would have custody.
Correct.
So by consent, under this agreement, the two girl or the children would be residing with the wife, ex-wife, in California. And there's an agreed-upon amount for support. And then the wife sues in California to increase support and serves the husband in New York. Jurisdiction?
I think that raises a different case.
Well, why would it be different? The husband has in advance agreed to take advantage of California law.
I would say it would
so
be
I
different.
Can't, well, I, all I'm bringing it up for is I would think it would recur time and time again, this question.
I would answer that by saying, in this case, we had a substantial change in the status of the children after the making of the agreement.
Well, that may be so, but what's that got to do with jurisdiction?
I think it has to do with the reasonableness of the contacts, which led the California Supreme Court to feel that the exercise of jurisdiction was reasonable in this case.
Do you think the California Supreme Court either in retired Justice Sullivan's opinion for the court or in Justice Richardson's dissenting opinion, that the members of the court thought that they were dealing with a constitutional issue, a federal constitutional issue?
I think they felt they were dealing with the application of Code of Civil Procedure 14.
Justice Richardson, in his dissenting opinion, begins by saying, in my view, it is unreasonable to subject petitioner to the jurisdiction of the California courts under the circumstances in this case. And then he goes on with the facts and so on. He never is explicit in saying that, in his view, it's unconstitutional.
That's correct.
Nor, indeed, does Justice Sullivan's opinion deal with the question as though it's a constitutional question.
That is correct.
Was it presented to that court as a constitutional question?
No, it was not, Justice Stewart.
It was not?
Was not presented as a constitutional question. It was presented as to whether or not this particular case fell into the statute, California Code of Civil Procedure 1410.10.
It's presented to us in the jurisdictional statement as a constitutional question, whether California's construction of your Civil Practice Act extending in personam jurisdiction over the non-resident appellant violates the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. That was never presented to the California Supreme Court?
That is our position, Justice.
Well, that's a matter of fact,
yes,
not a matter of somebody's position.
That's a matter of fact, Justice Stewart. It was not presented that way to the California Supreme Court.
Ms. Starn, doesn't the California Supreme Court expressly say that the limits of the statute are defined by the Constitution?
Where is that?
And in page Roman 5 of the jurisdictional statement, points out that the court of this state may exercise jurisdiction on any basis not inconsistent with the Constitution of this state or the United States, and later that the case of the statute as construed manifests an intent that the courts of California utilize all such bases limited only by constitutional consideration.
That is
correct.
Didn't
the court necessarily decide a constitutional question when it decided there was jurisdiction?
I think it was inferring that decision was limited by constitutional perimeters, but that it was not really
she's got Harry's vote right there.
Construing the Constitution in this particular situation.
Listen to this for just a moment. The holding of courts, talking about the lower court's holding, accords with established due process principles. I'm quoting from page 8 of your motion to affirm. So you recognize it, didn't you? Did you recognize due process?
I think it would be fair to say that, Justice Marshall.
In fact, the analysis of the California court is whether International Shoe or Hansa against Dekla required a different result. Those are federal cases.
Yeah.
That's correct, Justice Stevens. I'd like to move to the issue of mootness, if I may.
Before you go to that, since we've got you interrupted anyway, let me be sure I understand your position. Suppose we have two different cases, one the case we actually have, and a second case in which the settlement agreement itself had said the children shall be given to the mother, be in the custody of the mother who shall reside in California. That's all it said, and then had agreed upon amount. And then thereafter the mother brought suit to increase the support allowance. Would that be a stronger or a weaker case for jurisdiction in California under your view?
Well, it would be weaker in the sense that there would have been less acts by the father causing an effect.
But there would have been a clear consent to the children being there, unambiguous and all that. And he paid the tickets and say in my
it
case.
It would be strong in the sense that the contract was to be performed there in many instances.
Well actually... the children's presence would certainly be the effect of his having made and signed that agreement in New York, wouldn't it?
That's correct.
So how would the issue be any different than the one we have now?
Well, only that the contract that we have in the instant case was to be performed partly in California because he was to pay support there when children were in her custody.
Well, partly or not, if your Supreme Court's test, whether or not he committed the children to the benefits of California law, under the agreement he did, didn't he? Even though if only partially.
That's correct.
Well, then is the constitutional issue any different?
No, the constitutional issue would not be different.
Well, you wouldn't claim that California
would have jurisdiction, though, would you, if there was custody was litigated in the divorce court and custody was awarded to the mother?
I think that would depend as to whether it was understood in that custody litigation that the mother lived in California.
Well, everybody knew she lived in California, and the father was ordered to pay and mail to California $300 a month for child support.
I think there is some distinction, Justice White, because...
Well, do you suppose your California court would think that set of facts satisfied the California test? Of something done outside by the defendant?
Well, I think a voluntary...
If he resisted the custody decree?
Well, no, I think that would be different, Justice Brennan, but I think an agreement entered into...
Well, it's an agreement that may make...
Let me give you another one.
It's a contract.
Let me give you another one.
The mother now moves to Oregon and wants more money, files suit in Oregon, and the father's never said a thing about Oregon. Is there jurisdiction in the Oregon court?
I think that it begins at that point, Justice White, to get weaker because there are not the contacts with Oregon that we have with California.
Well, did not the California Supreme Court place the rather long-arm jurisdiction here on the proposition that he, in effect, sent the children and submitted them to the custody of the state of California and all its protections?
That is correct, Mr. Chief Justice.
So that wouldn't apply. He's never done that with respect to Oregon.
That's right. So Oregon be distinct.
Oregon couldn't have any jurisdiction over him.
And I do not believe that jurisdiction would be the same. But this was not a unilateral act. Sending a child of 11 and a half to California with a one-way ticket plus all of her clothing is not a unilateral act on behalf of the child. It's a deliberate act in which the father participated and helped.
Ms. Thorne, I'm still not sure you answered my question. I don't know if you did or not. Would the case, the alternative case where it's in the settlement agreement itself, be stronger or weaker than this case?
I don't understand the case.
Where,
in your view?
Where the custody
where
is to be
this,
in
the
California.
The settlement agreement between the husband and the wife provide that the children shall reside in California with the mother.
And that he will pay support.
And he will pay support.
To them in California.
Yeah.
I think it would be stronger.
Stronger for jurisdiction in California.
For jurisdiction.
I see.
But I think we have the intervening force here of active acts on the part of the father, which resulted in these children being residents of the state and needing to be supported
Mrs.
in California.
Thorne, let me ask you a question about the active acts. Let's assume, for example, that the husband had not paid the airfare of the daughter to California. What acts would you then rely upon?
Had not paid her airfare, had not sent her with her clothing.
Well, the facts are clear, I take it, that the daughter asked to go back to her mother in California, or to go to her mother in California.
Yes. The other acts would be, with respect to the boy, the father called the social service agency in San Francisco, and that's in the record, and requested that that social service agency investigate.
Because he'd run away, and he run away from the father?
No, he had left, but he had told the father that he was going.
Well, your Supreme Court said that as to the boy, what the father did would not subject the father to in persona of jurisdiction. Didn't so hold it.
They said that
standing alone. Finally brought him
alone.
In on the increased support order, but had there only been the boy, apparently... there had been no in personam jurisdiction sustained.
That is correct under the opinion. However, I was pointing out some acts that he did take with regard to the boy. He had the social service agency investigate the home and make a report to him. He then wrote a letter to the mother, which is part of the record, saying we must renegotiate our bargain because it is no longer applicable to the circumstances as they have developed.
And you say writing a letter... was activity in California? He was in New York when he wrote the letter?
Yes.
And you say writing a letter to somebody in California is activity in California?
I believe.
Of a kind that'll submit you to the jurisdiction of a California court and to order you to pay money?
Certainly not standing alone, but I believe it was a recognition by him that he had, by his activity, done acts in California and that he realized he had to change their agreement.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock. You may continue.
Thank you. I'd like to raise next the case of McGee versus International Life and point out that in that case, the court found that one contact with the state of California was sufficient in the case of an insured under a life insurance contract.
Ms. Thorne, I think you were before lunch going to be started to address when we interrupted you your point as to the fact of that your claim, at least, that the plaintiff in this, the husband in this case, waived his claim by making a general appearance. Were you going to do that?
Yes, I was going to address
whenever you wish in the course of your argument, but I'd be interested in what you have to say.
All right. With regard to the issue of mootness, California Supreme Court opinion was filed on May 26, 1977, and became final on June 25th. Appellant did not move for stay of the filing of the Supreme Court of California opinion, and thus allowed the Superior Court for the City and County of San Francisco to reacquire jurisdiction. We followed with a motion for various matters, including support and for a determination of the very substantial arrearage that Dr. Kulko was in terms of support payments even under the agreement. appellant here filed a written response labeled a special appearance, and I believe all of the documents relevant to this have been lodged with the court. But in this response, he requested, pending appeal, that Mrs. Horn's motion be, and I quote, denied without prejudice, continued or stayed. Appellant's attorney also spoke to the judge by telephone and wrote a letter to the judge on September 8, 1977, which letter is shown in our brief at page 10. We contend that appellant's activities before the Superior Court for the City and County of San Francisco, State of California, constituted more than a special appearance and constituted a general appearance, waiving his rights to pursue jurisdiction further.
Ms. Thorne, I think it was some 40 or 50 years ago this Court decided a case in which it said that one could pay a judgment rendered against him by the highest court of a state and not supersede it and nonetheless pursue an appeal here without the case becoming moot. Do you see much difference between that situation and the situation you've just described?
Well, here we are, they are raising jurisdictional issue and making a special appearance only. And there was a request for a continuance, which has been held many times, to constitute a general appearance. I don't know that payment of a judgment constitutes a general appearance in the same sense as a request for continuance.
Did you urge this ground in the state court?
This happened after the state court opinion became final, Justice White.
Did you urge it in your motion to dismiss? In this court? You want to borrow my cup?
I do not believe it was urged, well, Justice Marshall.
Another thing is, what law determines? California law or federal law?
As to whether or not the issue's moot?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Well, you raising it.
Justice Marshall.
You are the one that's raising it.
It would be our opinion.
Well, if it's moot in California, it's moot here, isn't it?
I would think so, Mr. Chief Justice. Under California law, it is clearly moot under the cases which say that a request for a continuance is a general appearance.
Well, but wouldn't there be a federal element in this court's decision as to whether the petitioner or appellant is free to pursue his remedy by way of appeal here and nonetheless protect what he conceives to be his pending interest in the state trial court while we are have the appeal before us?
I think that he had the right to protect, as Your Honor suggests. He could have done that, however, by moving to stay the filing of the Supreme Court of California opinion so that it did not become final, thereby putting jurisdiction back in the Superior Court. He did not do that.
But, Ms. Stone, are you really asking us to determine what constitutes a general appearance, or more accurately, whether the things that you're talking about constitute a general appearance under California law? How are we competent to do that?
Roy, I'm asking that you recognize that in asking for a form of affirmative relief from the California Superior Court, that appellant made a general appearance, causing the matter to become moot at this level. I'd like to make a few more points on the merits. And in that connection, I'd like to return to the McGee case, where the court found that one contact with a California insured was sufficient because California had shown a manifest interest in providing effective means of redress for its residents when their insurers refused to pay claims. The case also mentioned that there would be some inconvenience to the Texas insurer from having to defend in California, but that this did not constitute a denial of due process. I would suggest to the court that the state has a manifest interest in protecting the welfare of the children who reside there.
May I get back to this general appearance business? I gather you concede that everything happened before the coming down of the California Supreme Court opinion, save the failure to move to stay the coming down of that opinion.
No.
Everything that he did before that in no wise prejudiced the special appearances he'd been making through the Superior Court. No.
Prior
right?
to the rendering of the California Supreme Court opinion.
So everything that your reliance for in the argument that what he did to constitute a general appearance, everything occurred after the coming down of that opinion, right?
That is correct.
And apparently in order to preserve his opportunity to come to this court. Is that it?
That is correct.
That's the opinion that's before us.
Excuse me, I didn't.
That's what's before us, is the Supreme Court's judgment and opinion.
Yes, I believe that the documents with regard to the proceedings in the San Francisco Superior Court subsequent to the rendering of the Supreme Court opinion of the state of California have been lodged with the court in our
And it sort of new pro tunc makes it moot before.
No, that happened after, Justice Marshall. The proceedings in the Superior Court of San Francisco took place in August of 1977, some 4 months after the Supreme Court of the state of California rendered its opinion and it had become final.
But Ms. Thorne, in your footnote on page 11 of your brief, you end up by saying there's no personal appearance as long as the court is not asked to exercise jurisdiction on the merits. And did your opponent ask the court to exercise jurisdiction on the merits? He asked him not to do that, didn't he?
In the San Francisco Superior Court, he asked them for a continuance.
He asked them not to decide the merits.
He asked them not to decide the merits, but he asked them for a continuance or a denial of the motion without prejudice. And that is a request for affirmative belief.
It's not a request for a decision on the merits.
It's just the opposite.
Just the opposite. I mean, maybe is there a California case squarely supporting you in this? Your authority seemed to me to be against you.
I believe we have cited in the brief the applicable cases. I'm looking for them.
Footnote 3, page 11. They all seem to be against you.
Well, those are different kinds of requests. It's clear under California law that a request for a continuance is a request or is a general appearance.
What case?
This is only a fallback position anyway.
Zobel against Zobel, that's it, I guess.
Yes, it's Zobel and Zobel at page 13, Justice Stevens.
For a request for a continuance to plead to the merits. But they didn't ask for a continuance to plead to the merits.
Well, they asked for a denial of the motion without prejudice.
Well, that's not the continuance to plead to the merits. He didn't ask for more time to answer, in other words. He maintained his position all along that there was no jurisdiction to decide the merits, whereas the case you cite is one that asked for a continuance so he can file an answer directed at the merits, which is quite different.
And the second case down, North versus City and County, where there was a written motion to continue the hearing, which we have here, was found.
If a party comes in and says, I want a continuance in order to file a special appearance, that would be a general appearance?
A continuance in order to file a special appearance would not be a general appearance under the express terms of California Code of Civil Procedure 418.10.
And where will I find that?
That is at the appendix to our brief, where California Code of Civil Procedure 418.10 is set out in its entirety, 418.10. But a motion to continue a hearing is a general appearance, and what appellant made here when he came into the San Francisco Superior Court after the rendition of the California Supreme Court opinion was a motion to continue the hearing, to deny it without prejudice, or to stay it. It was not his request for a continuance to file his special appearance that I'm referring to.
But he's not appealing from that, and you're not either.
We're suggesting that by that activity,
but
at
you're
that
not
time.
From, so far as I'm concerned, how does that get in the record? It's after judgment.
I believe that.
Isn't it after judgment?
That's correct, but appellant requested a stay from Justice Rehnquist of this court, and he attached portions of the record of the San Francisco Superior Court to his request for stay, and it is therefore part of the record and before the court. I would like to point out one further thing, and that is that appellant could have moved for dismissal of this case on the ground of inconvenient forum, which Code of Civil Procedure 418.10 clearly provides for, and without waiving any special appearance rights. He did not choose to do that. Therefore,
let me ask a question. If your client had moved to Hawaii, would you make the same argument?
The argument about the jurisdiction of the court?
Mm-hmm. I just want to move it a little further.
I don't think
so. This one's all the way across the country. But
you mean if she had moved to Hawaii prior to the child and
just
children?
Just exactly. Instead of California, she kept on going.
And the agreement had?
Yep. Everything else is the same.
The agreement provided for performance partly in California, not Hawaii?
No, everything Hawaii.
I said everything was in Hawaii. She went to Hawaii. The children went to Hawaii. You filed your lawsuit in Hawaii.
Then I would say that the situation would be the same, Justice Marshall.
It would be the same in New Jersey, too, wouldn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, it would. I wanted to point out that California has a special interest in the welfare of children residing there, more than it has in insurance claimants. They have an interest in the subject matter of the suit.
I believe your time has expired, Mrs. Thorne. You have 1 minute remaining, Mr.
Yes, sir. Briefly. The California Supreme Court specifically found that there was no knowledge by the father of Darwin's departure. Number two, I submit to the court that in the appendix to the brief, the court specifically finds that only a special appearance was made. Number three, on page 38 of
the appendix to the green brief.
The court specifically finds only a special appearance.
Thank you.
In the appendix at page 38, in my motion to writ of mandate, rather, page 38 is specifically set forth the challenges to the Constitution, the particular code section in question, and I cite Pennoyer versus Neff, International Shoe, Titus, et cetera, in response to earlier questions. And in conclusion, let me submit that in the search for fair play and substantial justice in all the cases that cite. When we go back to McDonald versus Mabee, Justice Holmes indicated, quote, in states bound together by a constitution and subject to the 14th Amendment, great caution should be used not to let fiction deny the fair play that can be secured only by pretty close adhesion to fact. Under circumstances where this court has already found mechanical and quantitative evaluations should not be a determination, to say that buying one airplane ticket is sufficient to make this type of connection, it seems to me, is going the other way from what this court has previously said. Thank you, sirs.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in United States.